Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of West Side Fairy Tales. I'm Tyler Bell, author, host, and reader, and I've got another great story for you this week. Today's tale is based loosely on my own life. I, too, lost a job I'd worked very hard to get, and I, too, had to take work as a night watchman at a construction site. Sitting there in the dark, alone, in the middle of nowhere, you will start seeing things. Little bursts of light and twists of shadow. The only thing more frightening than that, I believe, would be finding out the thing you thought you'd saw was actually there. Before we get to that story, however, I want to tell you about a book you may not have ever read. This week, it's Summer of Night by Dan Simmons. It's a horror story set around a group of children navigating their early teens in a bucolic farming community. But things get dark when a cabal of toothy leech things, reanimated corpses, and possessed school principals try to raise an ancient evil in the town. It's a great story, and it scared the hell out of me when I first read it over a decade ago. Check it out when you get a chance. Now, on to tonight's story. Without further ado, The Twinkling Cad. You've got to keep an eye out for the Twinkling Cad. He'll show you the worst time you've ever had. That was the phrase that popped into my head like a jolt of lightning the other day. Nothing more than a feeble-minded attempt at making sense of those first bright flickers in the distance. Death putting the spurs to his white horse with gusto. I'd been getting those jolts less often in these waning days of the Empire. As a young man, they'd rolled out over the expanse of my mind like heat lightning, striking the earth 1,000 times in silent concordance before the cracking waves of thunder poured over and threw me onto the pages in my typewriter. I'd sit, poring over this or that old book, and inspiration would find me. I'd notice something nobody had ever seen before, make some esoteric connection in the work, and then, bam! A few weeks later, I was giving lectures at Harvard, or holding court at the Lycee, or sitting VIP at literature summits in Prague. But that was before these waning days of the Empire. Before the lunatics took the asylum and locked up the staff. I imagine that often, you know. Them sitting outside rows of mesh-reinforced glass windows to point at us and laugh. You're the crazy ones now, 'cause we said so, and that's that. That's fucking that. It wasn't a fall from grace so much as a series of bruising tumbles. A misplaced first step at the top of the hill. You turn to catch your balance and your foot finds only air. Then too late, the grass below that. Soon you're backpedaling like mad. Arms flailing, drink mussing up the sat in front of your tuxedo shirt as you upend and cartwheel down into the gutter as though you'd planned it from the start. Woman gone. Condominium sold. The guitar you never played, pawned. You tell your friends it's just a phase. A chance to get started on that novel, or to reconnect with your blue-collar roots. You need to understand what it feels like to wear a blue-collar again, you say. And then even you start believing you'll experience something like a growth of spirit when that first crescent of dirt lodges itself beneath your nails. And when you sit on the toilet in your alphabet-numbered basement apartment at 3 a.m, picking that dirt loose with a plastic fork from the Chinese takeout box, you'll want to fucking kill yourself. Oh, I entertained thoughts of suicide when I lost my tenure at Penn. Head of the German department, $230,000 every year until I died. That's what I'd worked my whole life for. I scrabbled, kneeled, and begged, and sucked metaphorical cock like a vicious old prostitute until I achieved that goal. Then the legislature voted to remove the state's tenured positions and revamp the humanities into something the lunatics could all get behind. I could translate German text from variants of the language predating the Romans. The fucking Romans. Do you know what those fucking animals asked me when I reapplied for my own job? What do you know about Goethe? What work have you done on Wagner? I offered them the keys to the secrets of old Europe, and they turned me down for fucking Faust? May as well ask Tennessee fucking Williams if he could pen a limited run of the fucking Wiz. Oh yes, I entertained suicide when I lost my tenure at Penn. I had suicide over as a house guest when I couldn't find another professorship after that. Suicide had already moved into my house full-time, by the time my nth application to teach high school German had been rejected. But still, Suicide and I never danced. I never had the courage to just reach out and plant that first succulent kiss on Suicide's lips. To taste that carbide steel and gun oil. But Suicide remained on my mind and in my heart through those first months of searching through the classifieds for odd jobs. We'd even gotten into heavy petting by the time I finally found work as a third shift security guard at a construction site on the outskirts of the city where I'd grown up. I'd gone home to live with my parents when my luck had turned sour before, but now they were dead, and even that bit of respite was denied me. Still, I had no other home to retreat to. I moved into a part of town I'd never visited growing up, barely able to afford the deposit with the last of my savings. I'd burned through most of my cash trying to keep up appearances in front of my... not friends, no. That's not the right word. Neither is peer, or acquaintance, or contemporary. My herd is more like it, or, better yet, my school of fish. We were like a mindless cloud of like entities swarming through the cavernous dark of the ocean. None of us cared one lick for one another, but we depended life and limb on each other to survive, or as a sort of aimless hive mind, possessed of no greater purpose or instinct than to eat and fuck and shit out more fish, to be devoured by those quicksilver leviathans of the deep. Somehow, I'd fallen out of lockstep and wound up in the jaws of ignominy, and that creature didn't have the good decency to chew. No. Us blind swimmers aren't afforded the luxury of terrestrial deaths, those hard, toothy bites to the back of the neck and the instant dark that follows. No. Instead, I've been swallowed up whole, displaced and left to die in the stinking sewer of some labyrinthine gut. When I got the job as a security guard, I actually felt blessed. The looming threat of poverty, of somehow leading an even less dignified existence than my already precipitous fall, had humbled me more than an hour tied to a Roman pillory. I learned to speak in monosyllabic affirmations and negations, appending everything with a crisp sir or ma'am. I had to wear a uniform, but I didn't have to smile or pretend to be happy, which put me a fat hair and a few dollars ahead of the clerks at the drive-thru where I bought my breakfast before every shift. I never knew how cold nights are, even in the summer, until I started working them. I wore bulky thermals to work every night, and sometimes the other, younger guards would make jokes at my expense. Their bodies were still young and fresh and able to heat themselves under their own power alone. What hurts most is that the jokes were framed with a genuine concern for my comfort, or offers to take over my patrols during the colder midnight hours. A three-man post operated out of a drafty shipping container modified to work as a makeshift office. I say three-man, but there were the occasional women who stood post with us as well. I'd get my hopes up when I heard a woman would be standing post with me. Imagine some comely, middle-aged creature just as down on the luck as I, and how I'd spend a shift seducing her with my knowledge of ancient German esoterica. I was often disappointed on all fronts. We took turns running the two patrol routes out of the office, one on foot and the other in a company truck. The point of the exercise was to deter local kids and other degenerates from entering the site, a sprawling, multi-million-dollar bridge and tunnel project, and defacing a stealing property. Both routes took about an hour to complete, and the foot patrol was by far the worst, meandering through the shapeless graveyard of dormant construction equipment over uneven and mucky terrain with only a flashlight to guide me. There were no sidewalks in construction sites, I learned, though I didn't know why I had expected there would be. I ended up pawning my last good blazer in my microwave for a pair of sturdy Chinese boots. But I suppose the driving route is worse, because that's where I first saw the thing. The driving route leaves north from the makeshift office. You take the company car and head up to the new highway, and then follow it along past the mall to the exit that leads to the interstate. Then, you loop through the clover leaf, shoot back down south, and drive through the mostly finished tunnels and then through another clover leaf to head back to the office. The route is simple, but long and slow. The unfinished road won't allow for speeds over 10 miles per hour. The new highway is unlit and littered with construction debris. Cement trucks, excavators, flatbeds, tampers, steamrollers, and other hulking things with no discernible purpose. They all stand in shadow like sentinels, either beside the road or in it. In that formless dark, in the early hours of the morning, it's easy to believe you're seeing things. Often you do. Little flickers in the corner of your eyes. One of my coworkers, Marcus, calls them darters. They get real bad when you've been up a long time, he said. Marcus had done time overseas with the army, a time he seems reticent to speak of and yet is always somehow mentioning. I had a guy in my squad, Jonathan, called them shadow cats. He was an Indian, yeah. Said you shouldn't try to look at them or they'd look back at you. Jonathan was a fucking nut, though. Marcus was certainly right about the darters getting bad early in the morning. They were especially noticeable in the quiet periods when you were alone on post or patrol, with only the unpredictable bump and dump night sounds to keep you company. I learned in the first few months that your brain strives to make sense of the darkness, welding nightmare creatures together out of bits of shadow to appease its own craving for form. That's why I didn't believe my eyes when I saw it scrambling up the side of the mall parking garage. My brain didn't want to believe it either. Normally, any such inventions were its own welcome constructs, as easy to dismiss as they were to develop. Nonsense crafted of nonsense, but this was different. My mind reeled in spite of itself, trying to make sense of the thing by cloaking it in fiction. Perhaps it was a trick of the leaves beside the garage wall casting shadows in the wind. Perhaps it was just a portion of my retina adjusting to the different quality of light on that side of the road. Perhaps I'd fallen asleep at the wheel. That thought made me press the brake pedal to the floor involuntarily. The wheels locked and the tires squalled against the pavement. The sound snapped me more awake than I had been all night and my heart began to beat in my chest. My mouth had gone bone dry, and my tongue stuck painfully to the soft flesh at the top of my throat. The thing froze in mid-climb for just a second, and then looked over its shoulder at me. I hit the accelerator and drove away far too quickly, bounding over the loose, rocky dirt hard enough to bounce my head against the roof of the truck cab. I told myself I hadn't seen what I thought I'd seen as I rounded out the rest of the rough hour it took to do my patrol. It couldn't have been anything, I knew, because my eyes had just been playing tricks on me. It had just been a cheap optical illusion, an evolutionary byproduct of the fight-or-flight response. Even if it had been anything, he's probably just some kid, or other sort of degenerate type, out getting his thrills in the weird ways people did in these later years. I felt better once I got back to the guard shack. I'd driven fast enough to beat the other patrol back by about 15 minutes. The guy on post, a perpetually tired Greek named Sebastian, commented on my early return. I told him I needed the restroom, and he nodded sagely and went back to his book, an ornately covered Orthodox Bible. The rest of the night passed without incident, though I was far more trepidatious than usual crossing through the boneyard of the construction site on foot. But nothing happened, of course. By the time I stepped back into the guard post, I was chuckling about the incident, and even considered relating my story to the other guards. I thought better of it when I considered they might make jokes at my expense. And when they left me alone in the post to carry out the next hour's patrol, I wished I'd had. Nothing happened, of course. I just simply sat there, twiddling my thumbs between stabs at one of Tolstoy's door jams. But with every passing hour, I grew more nervous, more frayed. I emptied the percolator in 3 cups, and by the end of my hour, my hands had both gained a subtle palsy. Caffeina nervosa. An uncharacteristic fear of the dark had come over me with all the swift fury of a gathering storm. It came as a drizzle and stayed as a monsoon. You see, the darkness beyond the well-lit structure is thick. It becomes a wall, a plasticine border between the cold security of the light and the mad chaos beyond it. You hear all manners of sounds in the night, and No matter what you tell yourself, no matter the petty rationalizations and the oh-so-simple explanations, you hear death in that void. You hear death in every tumble of rock. You hear death in every twitching blade of grass. You hear death in every inexplicable scrape and chitter. And no matter what you tell yourself, death is really out there. He lends his credence to fear in all its myriad permutations. I believe, truly believe, that mankind would never have adopted films as entertainment were our minds not already wired for such a preposterous undertaking as watching moving pictures. But we already knew of another screen, the one we'd stared out into since our oldest days, breaking rocks and caves at the edge of prehistory. What horse have we projected onto that black film in those years since? And of those horrors, how many have we brought back from the firmament of imagination to wreak upon the living? Myself, I saw that odd white thing. I saw its impossible and sinewy muscles pushing it more quickly up the wall of that parking garage than any human could have hoped to climb. I saw its fishy head and its fat, oblong body, so like that of an iguana, I wondered if I hadn't just formed it from the addled ether of my old mind. I forced myself to believe it was more Gollum than Dybbuk, and I found solace in that idea. Or rather, I convinced myself that I found solace. In truth, I spent my short time on post nearly shot through with nerves. Every scrape of sound was a fertile seed for my imagination, and trees with broad black leaves sprouted from the ground where they fell. I convinced myself I saw the thing walking brazenly toward me through the dark. I focused until I almost visualized it standing there, too tall and thickly muscled despite its lankiness. Then I almost had a heart attack when I caught a flicker out of the corner of my eye and, convinced the thing had snuck up on me, shot out of my chair with enough force to send it skidding across the room. Normally, in times of stress, I write or recite the upcoming week's weather. I'm a voracious newsophile, and since my youth, I've had an odd penchant for remembering the 7-day weather forecast, which I can recite verbatim. I used to calm myself before speeches or other difficulties by doing so, but I'd never had to use the trick more than once in an entire week, much less multiple times in a single hour. The other guards gave me piteous glances when they found me mumbling next Saturday's forecast in the grips of a caffeine fed upon their return. I smiled and mumbled some excuse for my behavior that they politely ignored. I did another shift on foot, and God only knows how I forced myself through that. Truth, I remember little of it save the sound of my boots crunching over the dirt and the shadows whirling around me. I welcomed the rising sun with a relief unlike any I'd ever experienced. Apollo bled his way out of the horizon over the last hour of my shift, and when the long shadows of the trees on the opposite side of the highway could no longer hide his light, I got into my car to depart for home. I tell myself I didn't see the fat orb of a lidless eye slink behind one of those trees as I started the car. I tell myself that, and I often believe it. Cold weather came, and soon we were patrolling partially finished segments of bridge over the interstate and the first intestinal reaches of tunnels dug into the rock beneath our patrol station. The walking patrol became a grueling slog through brown slush and the unchecked winds that blew through the treeless corridor. But even as my life faltered, it became more enjoyable. I grew accustomed to my simpler life. The work was grueling but invigorating. I came to understand that I had not spent my life working hard, as I'd come to believe, but simply completing the necessary steps to achieve my goals. Hard work, I learned, was hard because there was no end to it. It came with no reward, no greater meaning. It came with little money, less recognition, and no understanding other than you could always have a harder job. There were only worse lots in life, and your own, and nobody wanted to hear you complain. Your griping could only remind others that they were either suffering more than you, or could suffer more. One could only hope that their hard work would end before they themselves ended, that they could enjoy some small amount of comfort at the end of life's day. I grew hungry from lack of funds, and soon grew thin, and then I was no longer so hungry all the time. My pants began to fit better, and then didn't fit at all. My back began to ache just slightly all the time, but the wheeze I'd had for years that followed walking up any flight of stairs had disappeared. I drank more often, but I did so with the friends I met at work. We knew each other by our first names and never knew much more about each other than that, except on the rare occasion when one of us would have woman troubles or too much to drink and spill our guts harder than a dishonored Japanese. But for all this, I never truly became happy. I suppose I had arrived at an age where happiness is no longer necessary. What I felt instead was what one might call a detached contentedness, though I believe the feeling has no real equivalent term in English. I began only to notice the comforts of the day, and the encroaching deep winter. I lived for the weekends, not to enjoy life, but to eschew it, in favor of television shows I began to follow religiously and the sports games I began to watch as a matter of conversational preparation. Through all these intervening months, the thing I'd seen that odd, dark night remained in my thoughts. I saw it mostly in my dreams, which I often forgot upon waking, all but the black, lidless eyes. One dream, however, I remembered, if only for its bizarreness. I sat in the sterile waiting room of a hospital, a doctor's office. My seat was warm from someone else when I sat down. I knew I had to be called soon. I'd been waiting so long. The magazines and newspapers on the table in front of me were old and yellow. All of them were tattered and missing pages, some so brittle they fell apart in my hands. I read them anyway, cover to cover, to alleviate my boredom, though I can't remember a single story. Then I heard the ringing. The person behind the glassless receptionist's window had begun slamming a hand down on the silver bellhop's bell in the counter. The blows came in rapid staccato. Ding, ding, ding. I snapped my attention to the counter, knowing my time had come. The thing I'd seen scaling the parking garage hung half out the window, slapping its long-fingered hand down on the bell and smiling at me. Or rather, baring its teeth. They finished the highway and most of the bridge by the low point of winter. Or maybe the high point of winter. Really, whatever you'd like to call that portion of winter that is the most fucking painful. That time when your ears and toes always seem cold no matter how thick you pile on the layers. When your bones throb and all you can think about is the long warm sleep at the end of the night. Our patrols were reduced, and so were our numbers. Soon we only ever had 2 men on post, drawn from the same pool of 4 and rotated week by week. We no longer patrolled on foot, and instead maneuvered the truck through the construction site and along the highway via a single 2-hour-long route. The icy terrain slowed the truck to a rumbling crawl in the lonely wreckage of the construction site. It was in these heatless winter nights I began to see the thing again, or truthfully, it became more audacious in its displays. I'd really never let off seeing it. Its comings were just confoundedly easy to dismiss. White skin would drift like smoke past the window of my cramped basement apartment while I brushed my teeth before bed. I would see the shadows of clawed figures intermingling with the silhouettes of tree branches that grew out over my front door. It was around then, too, that my mind sprang back into action, sparked, as it were, by some outside force. Almost like an old hand-cranked engine being spun to life by sheer force of will. The words were there, as were my well-worn turns of phrase and methods of observation, but they were twisted somehow. They felt more like a deft impersonation than an original work. First of all, they all revolved around the creeping white thing, which further cemented its already tight-fisted grip on my mind. They came in bits and starts, sudden and unbelievably crisp factoids. These tidbits surrounded the thing's murky origins and its bizarre feeding habits. How it selected a single, hapless victim and marinated that individual over the course of months. But most off-putting was this single snatch of rhyme that popped into my mind during a shower. Got to keep an eye out for the twinkling cad. They'll show you the worst time you've ever had. It came to me in a sort of sing-song melody, almost taunting. In truth, almost as though I were hearing somebody singing it into my ear from just behind me. I could almost feel their breath on the side of my neck, feel the rub of their chin on my shoulder as they worked the words out over their lips. I wondered what kind of teeth they had, and imagined a maw filled with steel knitting needles that had been hammered flat against some uneven surface. At that moment, I'd heard a slamming noise just on the other side of the shower curtain. I gasped and nearly fell, my eyes opening and then immediately snapping shut as the shampoo running over my face scalded them blind. I slapped water over them and tried to focus on my bathroom through the blur. Shapes moving in the haze of steam and fogged glass. Something white? Certainly not. I'd washed my face furiously, heart pounding, and then stepped out of the shower with my frail arms raised foolishly in front of me. Any honest burglar, seeing me in that sorry state, would have known in that instant all I had belonged to him. But I had no other recourse. I refused to be had in a shower like some silver-screened scream queen. I blinked away the tears my eyes had formed to scrub away the suds. Nothing. I glanced down and noticed the toilet seat perpetually up in my bachelor's flop had fallen down. That accounted for the sound, but how had it happened? The bathroom door stood slightly ajar. I stepped through it into my hallway and felt a chilly draft coming from my room. The door to that hung open as well, and the room beyond was far colder than when I had left it. I stepped inside and saw the window at the far end, beside my desk, had swung open while I'd been in the shower. Obviously due to some mechanical failure of the window. I'd have been so disappointed with myself if I had written this just a year ago. It carries all the telltale signs of a hackneyed writer. Hackneyed premise, the monster only the protagonist sees, hackneyed device, the apocalyptic log. But it's hard to remain angry with myself. Even looking back just at the top of this scribbling, I can see my old anger bleeding out of me sentence by sentence. That sort of invective is hard to carry with you for any long period of time, especially when you're my age. No wound can bleed forever, I suppose. I started writing this just a few hours ago. Yesterday, technically, if you take the hour into account. How do I put this? I saw it. I really saw it. The thing. No long-distance sighting, a brief flash in the corner of my eye. I really saw it. I'd been driving through the construction site, listening to public radio and letting my thoughts wander. I found that, when they wandered, they were less likely to find their way back to the thing. This time, of course, I was wrong. I turned the corner around a squarish piece of equipment the size of a city bus, and there it was, tucked into the hollow between the machine and the concrete pad beneath it. Its posture reminded me of a frog, limbs bent and splayed out to its sides. It had crushed the throat of a white-tailed deer and dragged the helpless animal into the little cubby. Blood stained the already dirty snow a darker shade of brown. The deer had yet to die, and its mouth worked open and shut grotesquely. Yards of intestines lay spread out in the halo of the truck's yellow headlights. The thing raised its hand and wriggled its fingers at me, and I punched the accelerator. The truck lurched through the construction site, bounding over the ruts in the path and throwing me against my seatbelt. I lost control of it in a nasty patch of snow and ice and slid sideways into the treads of an excavator. The crunch of steel was more than enough to let me know I'd likely seen my last day of employment with Walther Security. I turned out onto the highway and screeched to a halt just in time to see the deer's carcass sail across the road in front of me. It bounced just to the right of the median and unfurled like some horrific puzzle toy, sending viscera and offal spraying in an arc around it. I looked right and saw the thing standing on the berm beside the road, its chest glistening with the deer's blood. It began walking toward me, and I accelerated, breaking the speed limit by more than double until I had made it back to the guard shack. The other guard, a short young Mexican named Jorge, wasn't there. He should have been there, but he wasn't. I locked the door and shut the open window over by the coffee machine where Jorge would have been sitting. I sat in the same chair and buried my face in my hands. Jorge should have been there, you see. He should have been in the office. It was no good just sitting there and thinking about how the handsome young man had big, trusting brown eyes. Just like a deer's eyes. So here we are. The truck's outside where I left it, and there it will remain. Jorge has yet to return. Jorge will not return. The phones don't work for reasons beyond my understanding. Perhaps the lines were cut. Perhaps that's where Jorge is, or where he went, to inspect the phone lines and see whether they were cut. You know what's strange? I have no idea what phone lines look like. The ones that go to the phone in your house or office, sure, but the ones that go to the building itself? No idea. Just a bunch of black wires to me. How, then, would some strange thing know to cut the wire? Perhaps it just found something to chew on, and somebody interrupted its time with its new chew toy. Or perhaps I'm thinking too far into things. Thinking is an old man's game, and one of the few games I'm good at anymore. I had blurred the line between dream and reality long before seeing the thing in the dark. Long before even losing my tenure. Long even before the lunatics began their painfully slow takeover of the asylum, I had lost track of the border between the world I'd idealized and the world in which I actually lived. I had believed I was somebody. A definite article. Perhaps even the only somebody in all God's green creation. Now here with the end in sight, I understand how small my role was even before it was diminished. The only difference between how I was going and how I ended up is that, if my career had never been impeded, I'd never have been able to see the truth through my own gilded eyes. Despite all of my accomplishments, I would have died as all lucky men do. Alone, old, and afraid. Something outside is tossing small stones against the side of the building. The small raps are oddly spaced and frightening when they come. I wish there were more of a pattern to the noises. I'd like to think that perhaps I'm just a foolish old man and that's Jorge outside, trying to get my attention because I locked him out. I know it is not. When I'm afraid, sometimes I recite the 7-day weather forecast to calm myself down. I don't want to make any noise right now, so I'll just say it as quietly as I can. Tuesday, low of 22. And a high of 45. Clear skies. Wednesday. Low of 20. And a high of 40. Slightly cloudy. Thursday. Low of 15. And a high of 33. Overcast.
Well, folks, that was The Twinkling Cad. I hope you enjoyed it. I have some good news and bad news for you listeners. The release of this episode means we're officially into the second half of West Side Fairy Tales' first season, and we only have 4 episodes left. That's the bad news. The good news is we'll have another episode for you in just 2 weeks. As always, you can keep up to date on all things West Side Fairy Tales by following us on Twitter at WSFairyTales. Liking our West Side Fairy Tales Facebook page, and subscribing on iTunes and YouTube. Thanks for listening, and remember, stay safe out there. West Side Fairy Tales is written, read, produced, and scored by Tyler Bell. All content herein, copyright 2017, Tyler Bell.